you're looking for weapons, if you're looking for the tunnel entrances, just go straight to the children's bedrooms, because that's where Hamas have put them.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall never die.
My guest for today is a best-selling author. He published his first book when he was 21 years old, studying at Oxford English Literature. I must say before we begin that I am very anxious for this interview because my guest typically is the one asking the questions, not answering the questions. And on the rare occasions that he has been interviewed, I've seen him just out of thin air quote 19th century poems in response. So I may be over my head in this, but nice. Here I am with Douglas Merry.
Very nice to be with you. Promise you're not in over your head.
Douglas, I am going to start with the question that I ask all of my guests. Douglas Merry, what are you fighting for?
Well, I think it's quite straightforward, because I'm fighting for the values that I was brought up to believe I could live in and my society could sustain, fighting for a culture and a way of life and a way of thinking, which allows thinking. And yes, I mean, I was born in Britain at a time when we were still under the belief, which I think is not erroneous, that Britain was a force for good in the world. Admired America, because still in those days, not that many years ago, America was still a good idea and had been a force for good in the world. And yes, I suppose beyond that, there are some specifics. I deeply, deeply wish to keep certain parts of our society free from politics. You know, somebody once said about philosopher Leo Strauss, what was Strauss's real philosophy? And one of his students once said, I think that Strauss's philosophy was to keep the world safe for philosophy. And I would say my belief, among other things, that I want to keep the world safe for culture and philosophy and thought and free inquiry and much more. And that certain preconditions have to be in place for that to be possible. And that slowly in recent years, the spaces in which that could be done have been eroded. Everything has been politicized to an extent which I find deeply boring. And I'd find it boring whatever the politicization was. But, you know, I don't want to be preached to about a boring set of non-ideas. If I go to the theater, if I go to a concert, if I go to a film, if I go to a lecture, I don't want that. I want a much wider array of opinion to be out there and for it not to be monotone.
So you say, you know, the words that you kept repeating are values, culture, thinking or philosophy, the love of thinking. What are those values for you?
Well, they're a rather specific set of values, which a lot of people now disdain, but I believe it's quite straightforward. What I would call Western values, obviously based on our Judeo-Christian inheritance, as well as the philosophy of the ancients in Greece and Rome, refined in the fires of the Enlightenment, which have given us the culture which a lot of people now seem to think rather like fish in water is just the natural element. But I've traveled widely enough around the world to know that what a lot of people think is a natural element in our societies is very uncommon geographically today and historically almost non-existent. Certainly a sort of blip in human history that we've had the rights and the freedoms that we currently enjoy. So I want to sustain them and, I want them to be passed on. I would like them to be sustained for future generations. Not because I don't think that they're not capable of improvement or of fine tuning, but because I don't foresee any system of burning it down or radically altering it that doesn't make the situation for everybody infinitely worse.
And there's an assumption here that you think these values, these beliefs, these thought systems are, if not under attack, or at least under peril.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They probably always have been, always are. It's easy to catastrophize the moment you're in as especially terrible, you know. And it's also sort of self-flattering, you know, because it makes you the...
Makes you feel special.
Yeah, absolutely. The sentry at the gate. But nevertheless, that probably is the case. Historically, values that are worth sustaining always need to be defended. And a certain sense of peril about them is one of the things that prepares people and readies them to sustain them. So I don't think the moment we're in is especially unusual in that regard, although there are certain aspects of it, which aspects of the assault on it, which are relatively new, for sure.
So what are these aspects, if you can paint them in very general terms, and then we'll go very specific later on?
I think the most striking one in our own day in the West is what a friend of mine, the late philosopher Roger Scruton, described as the culture of self-abnegation. That is, everything that is ours is bad, and everything that is anyone else's is good. That our own histories are not, there's a sort of boring, chauvinistic, flag-waving version always, which I don't particularly care for, which is that these are the only values, the only cultures, the only principles, and, you know, they're the best, rah, rah. I think that's been an aspect in some parts of the Western past, as it has been for everyone else. But there's a sort of natural element to that. What's unnatural is everything that we have is bad, uniquely so. That instead of being uniquely good or superior or anything like that, that we're noticeably, demonstrably inferior to everyone else. That is, as I said in my book, The War on the West, it comes in its sort of lowest grade form in things like, you know, we had slavery in our past, therefore we're uniquely guilty. You have any idea of that everyone has slavery in their past? It'd be very strange to go to African countries and say, you should feel like terrible and you don't have anything good because you had slavery. It'd be a very strange thing to do, and I think a lot of people would feel kind of annoyed that people were coming to them telling them that they had nothing going for them. The culture of self-abnegation relies on this, that what we have is bad, everything we have is tainted, and then this sort of absurd, obscene addition on top, which is everything that is anyone else's, if anywhere else in the world, is uniquely better. And that culture has really been a predominant one for several decades now in the West. I'd like to think it's sort of coming to an end. It was inevitably going to exhaust itself at some point because, among other things, of the breakdown of its own system of non-thought. But systems of non-thought can, of course, go on for quite a long time. Or as I like to say, you know, the Herbstein's law in economics, things that cannot go on won't. Mm-hmm. I was reminded some years ago by an admittedly slightly jaded but distinguished friend of mine who was an emeritus professor at Oxford. When I quoted Herbstein's law to him, he said to me, "Oh, Douglas, after a lifetime in academia, I can tell you that things that cannot go on usually do." So I don't think things simply break down by dint of their, you know, innate self-contradictions or anything like that. I think those have to be pushed to a breaking point. But
I do have to note that a lot of the self-abnegation does not come out of some hatred toward the self as much as fear of owning what is ours, good or bad.
Yes, definitely that. I mean, there's an interesting twist that my friend and colleague, the novelist Lionel Shriver, said to me on stage some years ago when I talked about the self-hatred that was being pushed on us. And she said, "But Douglas, you've got to remember that the people who are pushing the self-hatred don't have any self-hatred for themselves. They love themselves."
Right. I mean, I had this experience. I was in Sweden giving, I was a part of a panel, a very educated cultural audience. And we were having different discussions. And at some point I said that I believe Western values are superior.
Oh, that'll cause a meltdown in Scandinavia.
Well, what happened was very interesting. There was complete silence. And being the professor that I am, I called out the silence. I said, I want you to ask yourself, what happened in this millisecond? Did you disagree with me? Or did you agree with me but stopped your hands from clapping? I did not say that there's something bad with other values. I just said that I believe that my values, my culture's values are better. Just like I expect someone who grows up in India to think that their values are better.
Sure.
Just like someone in Africa. It's human. Mm. By the way, I still believe that in the question of, for example, female genitalia mutilation.
Yeah.
Values get it.
I'm very familiar better. With the silence you experienced in Sweden. There's a good version of this, which the late novelist Martin Amis demonstrated in about 2001, 2002 at a cultural event in London, which made a huge impression on him, which was that at some point he ended up in this sort of debate at the time. And he said to the audience, raise your hands if you feel morally superior to the Taliban. And I think one hand went up. And that's a very, very interesting thing. And I mean, we're still living in the sort of extrapolation of what Martin Amis was trying to do that night. He was by no means a sort of right-wing chauvinistic type, you know. He was an old-school liberal. And he was shocked by that. And a lot of the rest of us were shocked by it because it was like, well, if you don't feel morally superior to a group that stones women to death for alleged adultery, you've either got a deep moral problem or you're a kind of coward, or both, of course. But yes, we've all been living with that. And of course, one of the reasons why, and one of the reasons why your Swedish audience would have felt that way, is of an echo from the 20th century, which is more than an echo, which is a deep fear of saying in any context that what we have might be superior. And even I am careful about the language I use on this. Perhaps especially I am careful about it because I know the reverberations it can have. I mean, like you don't especially, what if you've been giving that speech or doing that panel in, say, Dusseldorf, there'd have been an even bigger layer of concern. So, you know, in a way, a lot of this is still particularly in Europe, but Europe, it's extrapolated out to North America and Australia and New Zealand and elsewhere, is this thing of what if we dare to say that our values are, for instance, superior to the values of the Taliban, might we not end up on this slippery slope where we invade Poland again? You know, it's obviously a reductio absurdum, but it's something like that. And who knows how long that'll last for? Maybe it'll last another century. Maybe it'll last another 6 months.
But we have to also point out the logical inconsistency of saying no idea is superior to another idea other than the idea that no idea is superior to other ideas.
Yes. Yes. Nicely put.
There's a logical inconsistency in this kind of way of thinking. But you have been described, and I love this because I think it really boils you down, part of who you are, is as someone who is very popular for unpopular beliefs, which begs the question, are you a contrarian?
No, not particularly. I don't actually like being described as a contrarian because it suggests... A contrarian is somebody who sort of deliberately takes the opposite view to everyone else in the room, you know. A defender of...
Another name for that is an Israeli, but yeah. I can say that, you can't.
I've seen that at work around Friday night tables. There's a usefulness, of course, of contrarians in society and so on, but I don't feel that I'm motivated by a desire to say that. I think I've I have, on a number of occasions in my life, said early what everyone else is thinking. Not everyone else, but I mean, said early what a lot of other people are thinking on a range of issues. But I don't seek, I mean, the unpopular opinion. In fact, quite often, I've found myself the defender of popular opinion. In fact, I think generally I have been a defender of popular opinion. It's just that it's often not the opinion that people in my position are meant to have, because we're meant to push writers and so on, are meant to push unpopular niche opinions and spit on the opinions of majorities. And I don't feel the urge to do that. I feel the urge to say what I think is true and defend it, whether it's popular or not. But I mean, I don't have a special desire to be the devil's advocate on everything by any means. Although, as I say, I credit that there is an important role in society for people who do that. I find them slightly tedious if they do it as a pattern.
Yeah. So I was thinking, preparing for this, about how it might be a bit weird being you right now, because you have been doing this for so long, and yet there are many people that have only tuned in the past year, 2 years, 3 years. And it's almost like we're tuning into season seven of Lost, trying to figure out how did we get here?
Having tuned out in about season one of Lost. Okay.
So how did you become Douglas Murray? Like, tell me about your parents, your upbringing. Because I have to say, you know, people looking at you and people that are only listening in, you know, other than your really cool sneakers right now, you're very well dressed. You're educated at Eton and Oxford College. You are, people will describe you as a white Christian male. You are the poster child of the elitist, you know, conservative whatever views. Mm. And yet that's not where you're coming from. That's not who you are. Where did you come from?
Well, I mean, I'm not very good at self-analysis, because I'm British, and we don't do it. I suppose in some ways I'm certainly a product of an educational elite, and I don't mind that at all. I'm very proud of that. I suppose I'm especially proud of it because I did that on my own. I was a scholarship boy, who ended up going through the state school system in the UK. Saw the very worst of that system, it has to be said, from the inside, and managed to win scholarships through a succession of schools that ended up getting me to Eton on a scholarship and then to Oxford University. I have very occasionally in my life been introduced as, you know, product of Eton and Oxford, and sort of had a sort of boo from the audience and the thing, because these things were associated with unearned elitism. But I don't feel any shame at all, any pride in that, because I earned it. I worked for it. And I was brought up an Anglican Christian, and was the first of my family to go to Eton or to go to Oxford. And so I have that a dual thing in me, which is both being part of, and certainly of, an elite, but not feeling the embarrassment that a lot of people who've been in elites feel, because I feel like, you know, I'm here because I worked. Certainly whenever anyone has sort of implied to me I have some kind of unearned privilege, I want to sock them in the jaw, mm-hmm. you know, and just say, you don't know a darn thing about me. So I find some of the presumptuousness about that deeply grating, but you know, people need a shorthand to describe people, I suppose, and your schooling is one way to do that, albeit a rather unsatisfactory one. I was brought up to know, to have, you know, moral view on things and to be able to say what's right and wrong, and then inevitably, like all of us, you know, you grow up and you you keep certain aspects of your upbringing and shed others. And I suppose I've shed some of my Britishness, much as it might surprise you, but I certainly shed some of it in that having lived in America for some time, I'm certainly a bit more American than I used to be. How that manifests is probably that I don't mind talking about success, or I don't mind, for instance, celebrating the success of friends, which is not a British trait. There's still a sort of thing in Britain that if somebody does well, it must be at the expense of someone else, you know.
It's a very zero-sum way of thinking. Yeah.
And I love the American thing. I've always loved the American thing since I came here to research my first book in the 1990s. I've always loved the American thing of the celebration of success. All the difference in the world in a society that celebrates success and one which is wary of it.
Interesting. There's so much more there, but I do have to keep going because there's another thing, trying to figure out who Douglas Murray is before he becomes Douglas Murray. You apparently, and this is where the internet goes iffy because I couldn't find the actual manuscript, you wrote a play called Nightfall.
Yeah, that's
about
right.
About Raoul Wallenberg.
That's right.
So that's a fact because
yes,
the internet
doesn't
have
it.
It
is a fact. Yeah, I'm still sitting on it. After my first book, it's the only thing I've written that hasn't been published. And I feel sort of funny about it. I haven't revisited it in a long time. This is like 20, 25 years ago now. After I wrote my first book, I was searching around for a subject for a second. And I landed on this very, very interesting story about Raoul Wallenberg and read everything I could. And I thought it would be a book, but it just didn't feel like a book. And you know this. I mean, certainly all writers know this. Sometimes a thing has a natural form and you're trying to find out what the form is to make it work in. And I became very interested in Wallenberg and interested in his story. Of course, he was the great savior of many Jews in Hungary in 1944. Is a great moral hero to me because he didn't have to do it. You know, he was a rather well-off Swedish, man who sort of got a position at the Swedish legation in Budapest when he realized everything was going to fall apart, and literally managed to get tens of thousands of Jews out of the grip of the Nazis and saved them. And his story has always interested me. And what particularly interested me, actually, and what the play was about a dinner he had with Adolf Eichmann in the fall of 1944. Eichmann was trying to get the Jews onto trains, and Wallenberg was trying to stop them getting on the trains. And I discovered they had dinner, and that was what the play was about. I just thought it was a very interesting midnight of the 20th century, not least because on the horizon was the glow of the Soviet advance. And then there's this thing. I'm definitely going to return to the subject at some point, but there was this extraordinary thing that, of course, at the end of as the Soviets were advancing and the Nazis left Budapest, Wallenberg drives towards the Soviet lines and is abducted by the Soviets and dies in the gulag. It's a slight mystery what happened to him. But for me also, it's a reminder of, the Central and Eastern Europe in the 20th century, was like caught in a vice. And there were so many people who were caught in that vice, Jews and non-Jews, between two horrific totalitarian powers. And I've always found that, and I still find whenever I'm in Eastern or Central Europe, I find that corner of history is just especially grabbing to me because it seems just like the worst vice to be caught in.
I think it's interesting, the story that you mentioned of Raoul Wallenberg having dinner with Eichmann and the entire context there of him being captured by the Soviets, because he really brings up the two main forces that I see of the 20th century, which is sometimes, despite what postmodernism wants us to believe, sometimes there is good and there is evil.
Yes.
And the second thing is, good doesn't always prevail.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. The storybook version would be, you know, that good always wins out. And I think that can be the case in the theological framework, you know, that in the end, everyone will be judged and held account for how they've lived. But I mean, it's one of the sad discoveries of adulthood that just because something is right does not mean it wins through. I was in Ukraine the other week and took some time off from being with the forces on the front lines to speak by invitation to a class of students at the university in Kiev. And it was a very moving and interesting for me, very stimulating afternoon. They were brilliant students. But I said to them at one point, you know, somebody's asking something about what it takes to be a writer. And I was talking about some of the technical stuff. And then at some point I said, you know, maybe one of the things that all writers really also need to know is that even the things you cherish and love most can be trodden upon by people utterly unworthy of them. And as I said to them, you've all learned that lesson a bit earlier than some of your counterparts, you know. Right. You sort of can't believe that the holy place could be destroyed. And then it is. And there's no justice. What do you do?
And what do you do?
Keep going. You keep going. You know, you one of the great things I've learned from my Jewish friends is the importance of the story being told in order to continue. I'll give you a quick example. I really have thought about a lot. I had a late friend, Jonathan Sacks, chief rabbi of the UK, who I was very privileged to have as a friend. And I remember some years ago, whenever I was doing a book, I used to go and see Jonathan and pick his brains. And he was so generous. And I once said to him, when I was writing The Strange Death of Europe, and I wanted to talk to him about some of the theological and philosophical ideas in the book. And at one point, you know, I was talking about non-believing believers, you know, whether or not in Christian Europe in particular, people could belong without believing, or indeed believe without belonging. And this was obviously something that Jonathan thought about a lot. And I said to him, I said, can I make a rather presumptuous point? Which I know quite a lot of your congregation, your synagogue. And it seems to me that quite a lot of them are atheists, at least not believers. I cringe now to think of saying this. And without missing a beat, Jonathan said, oh, yes, most of them, I'd think. And I was sort of startled.
That's the rabbi that I, as an atheist, always looked for.
Right. I said to him, but what do you make of that? And he said, Douglas, this year, 95% of British Jews will be celebrating the holy days. I thought, wow. I thought about that for a long time. And that's part of it. You continue even if you can't believe, even if you don't believe, you continue to be in communion with the belief, with the story, and you keep going. Knowing that, and also keeping your heart open to it, I think.
In a way, that's also goes to the bigger story of, you said, about Britain, about the United States, about Israel, about whatever country you're from. Even if you don't believe, you keep the story going.
Yes.
With the hope that you can reach up the ideals that you're talking about.
Absolutely. You continue to tend the fire, you know, and... I mean, one of my favorite quotes, Gustav Mahler famously said, you know, that culture is not the cultivation of ashes, but the preservation of fire. I'm just on the way here today. I was reading a story, a rather typical story of our time, that Shakespeare's birthplace, Stratford-upon-Avon, has been told to decolonize itself because it could become a shrine for white supremacy. I mean, as you, I'm sure, are aware, any remaining skinhead thugs desperate to go to a performance of Troilus and Cressida. They love the history plays in particular.
They're looking to tame the shrew.
Taming the shrew, one of their favourites. I mean, it's so preposterous, and it's a typical story of our era. It's so annoying. But the funny thing about it was that the people urging that Stratford-upon-Avon should decolonise themselves, which means, of course, saying that you're no good and so on, was that that claiming that Shakespeare was in some way the best was a sort of supremacist gesture. Of course, I find all this stuff risible and also offensive, as most British people would, which is because, on the one hand, Shakespeare is for everyone. And on the other hand, he is ours, and he came from us, you know, and we have the right to feel rather proud of producing the Bard. It doesn't mean other people can't share him. It's just that we're rather proud of him.
And it doesn't mean other people don't have their own version.
No, I mean, that's the whole point, is everyone has their own literature and their own canon. And one of the great joys of life is knowing the canon that is yours and then finding other canons of work and enjoying them. And
my family, we have our inside jokes. We have our songs that we only sing. We have the foolish things that we do. That doesn't mean that other families are not worthy.
No, and it doesn't mean you want every other family to sing your family's songs.
Yeah. But when you're at my house, right, you should expect that, you know, there'll be more of what we do.
Yeah.
And when you're at your house, we'll do more of what you do.
Absolutely. And that's fine. Yeah.
So I find that a lot of your demeanor, the way you think, is very, maybe this is British, but very logical. It does not come from a sense of emotional anger or frustration.
I certainly have plenty of anger and frustration in me, but I have the great joy of being a writer, which means I can get it out that way.
Because you've said in 2006, so this is almost 20 years ago, you said, and this blew me away because this was so long ago, any sensible person is a Zionist. You didn't even say he should be a Zionist. Have you said every sensible person is a Zionist? Again, as a professor, the first thing that comes to mind is like, this is a, you're making a logical argument. You're saying if you're sensible, you're a Zionist. If you're not Zionist, you're not sensible.
Well, I think it's funny. I'd forgotten that. I mean, it seems to me still to be true in that Zionism is simply the right of the desire, the urge of the Jewish people to have a homeland in their historic homeland and to be able to govern themselves in that place. And
but that could be seen as an emotional plea. What's the logical, you know, the sensible person's argument?
Well, Zionism? I mean, the Pakistani the nation was founded within a year of the State of Israel being recreated, and the people of Pakistan have the right to govern themselves in relatively new homeland. And if the Jews don't have the right to a state in their historic homeland, then the people of Pakistan have no right to where they are, and no one else has any right to where they are. And it'll be all for all. The case for the Jewish people having the right to self-defense in a state seems to me to be completely impossible to refute unless you loathe the Jewish people, frankly, because one of the lessons of history is that only the Jews will defend the Jews, sadly. I wish that wasn't the case, but it seems to me to be the case. And if there wasn't a Jewish state which had the right to have an army that defends the Jewish people and Jewish state, you have to offer up who your candidates are to look after the Jewish people. And here we enter really interesting historical terrain, because
are there any viable candidates?
I'm sure that the people who are anti-Israel have got a candidate to look after the Jewish people. The Europeans, for instance, have always done such a good job. The Arab Muslim world has always done such a good job of looking after their Jewish neighbors. Who are the candidates? I've never had an answer to that, because everyone I've posed it to who's an opponent always feel suitably shamed by the lack of candidates. Some people just will lie to your face and say things like, oh, no, 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 the Muslim world was always wonderfully, wonderfully receptive to its Jewish neighbors. You have to sort of have an asterisk and a footnote with all the massacres and pogroms over many centuries. But, you know, people do sometimes try that one. I haven't had anyone, since I've been posing that question, say to me, let's try the Europeans as the protector again, because that people are suitably shamed about that. They're not quite as suitably shamed by the behavior of the Muslim world towards the Jews. But yes, in that situation, I regard what I said all those years ago as being perfectly defensible.
Mm-hmm. So, which brings us to your new book on democracies and death cults, Israel and the Future of Civilization. And I wanted to speak a lot about this book before, but I feel like we can't speak about this book before we understand your previous two books. Hmm. I almost feel like you're writing a trilogy. Maybe you were intending to write
at that. This point, it's a quartet.
It's a quartet. Because your previous books were about identity politics, mm-hmm. and about anti-Western ideology. Mm. And now you're writing about democracy in Israel. And those three things, and identity politics, anti-Western, and the hate of Israel, in my mind, seem very connected.
They're all connected.
They seem like they're very connected in your mind. Some people might listen and not see the connection as clearly as possible.
Well, I do think that, I mean, they're all connected. It's a funny thing, writing books, that you know, you sometimes see patterns as they emerge that are harder to see in advance. But I was very worried about the emergence of what we now call identity politics in recent years, partly because I thought it was a highly divisive movement. And I mentioned in The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity, I mentioned in that book that already there was a tiny part of that book, but there was obviously a problem in the intersectional world about where to put the Jews. And I predicted then, based on certain things that had already happened, that the Jews were going to come out badly from identity politics, you know, that instead of being a group with the right to minority and persecuted status, they would be made into the uber whites. And that's exactly what has happened since. The book after that, my 2022 book, The War on the West, warned about this and tried to analyze and pick apart this anti-Western movement. And although Israel played very little role in that book, it was mainly about America, I could see again that Israel was becoming like the uber America. And what we've seen, I think, since the 7th of October 2023 has vindicated this view I had, which was that Israel was being turned into the ultimate culprit, that the arguments that were being made against Israel already were the same as the arguments being made against America and Britain and Europe and everything else, but even more so. In that, for instance, if you believe that settler colonialism was the great thing to fight against, my own country of birth, Great Britain, has not colonized anyone for some years now. But you could attack Britain still for being in the past a colonialist power. If you take that view that colonialism, for instance, is the ultimate evil or an ultimate evil, then once you apply yourself to Israel with this very, very untrue analysis, Israel becomes the settler colonial state in our time. And, you know, one of the things I said in The War on the West was, because I always try to, in my books, introduce not just the sort of the current events being, but the sort of deep substructure things that are going on. And one of the things I identified in The War on the West was of course, is that if you are against colonialism, for instance, or against slavery, and you are against that in the past, which is sort of fine, sort of pointless as well, because there's nothing you can do about the past. We're here because the past happened. And but if you are against that, there's no you get stuck in a cycle of unending guilt and unending self-flagellation, because nobody can forgive and nobody can ask for forgiveness. The mechanism of forgiveness as we understand it in our tradition is impossible. It's like a cycle you cannot break out of. And what's interesting in the case of Israel is that the allegations that have been made against, rightly or wrongly, but have been made against America and the rest of the West for history are being made against Israel in the now. So
what are those allegations? Spell them out.
They are settler colonialism, white supremacy, racism, apartheid, genocide, ethnic cleansing. This is the set of allegations which have been made either about the American present, usually about the American past, and about the Western present, but especially the Western past. And it's very, very interesting watching, I don't need to tell you, but watching people who have been educated or miseducated into this very, very unfair and inadequate interpretation of the Western past. Very interesting watching them level these precise allegations against Israel now. And one of my contentions, which I say in On Democracies and Death Cults, is that much of what we've seen in the post-October 7th world is really only understandable through the psychological nature of projection. That what we've really seen is people who have been caught in the cycle I described in the War on the West, you know, of being told you are guilty by dint of being born in America in the 21st century. You have an inherited guilt. You have to bear the weight of slavery and of colonialism and of white supremacy and of patriarchy and of God knows what else. And
the interesting thing, I'm sorry to cut you off, is that you're not only, if you're born American, but even if you choose to become American, you take on...
You take on the guilt, the burden.
Despite your ancestors not being from here. You take on this... Now you're guilty by joining this group.
Yes, absolutely. And I thought that it was, I said, you know, you cannot break that cycle unless you decide not to play that game. My suggestion is don't play that game. In the same way, as I say, that, you know, it would be very curious to go to Uganda and tell them that they must apologize. You know, but anyway, the point is that the projection, and this is one of my explanations for why the vicious, vicious distortions and lies and vehemence against Israel have occurred in the last couple of years, is because here is an opportunity to actually do something, if you fall for this whole shtick, is to do something in the here and now that could atone for it. Because you say, look, there's nothing I can do about 19th century colonialism. But if I'm told there's a state that is currently doing colonialism, I can put all of my ire and all of my fight and the meaning and purpose of my life onto stopping the colonialism now. And of course, so I say, on a psychological level, there's just an awful lot of projection that's going on. But I'd add, of course, an addendum to that, which is, and they've also been woefully misled. If you are anti-colonialist in the current era and you're interested in the Middle East, please God focus on Iranian colonialism. Focus on the colonialism of the... I won't say Iranian because of my Iranian friends who are loathe of the regime. The Islamic Revolutionary regime in Tehran. Look at and take on its rampant colonialism, which is happening in our lifetimes. Colonizing Iraq, colonizing Syria, colonizing Lebanon, colonizing Yemen, and so on. Don't give me this guff about Israel being the colonialist state.
So let's talk about the IRGC, because you wrote a book that is in many ways inspired, motivated by the October 7 massacre. Mm. But the book does not start on October 7, 2023. Mm. It starts on February 1st, 1979.
Mm-hmm.
It does not start in the Gaza envelope. It starts in Tehran.
Yes.
Why did you choose that date? What happened?
One thing that was on my mind was Emma Wilson's book, The Finland Station, which was a sort of a minor classic of the 1940s, 50s, where Wilson talks about the intellectual genesis of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And of course, the Finland Station is about the train that takes Lenin
back to
St. Petersburg. And this is, of course, as Churchill and others observed, the bacillus, the virus of Bolshevism comes on the train with Lenin. And you might say was the most disastrous train journey of the 20th century. The flight of the Ayatollah Khomeini from Paris back to Tehran counts, I think, as an equally terrible journey of the 20th century. The flight that took the Ayatollah back to Tehran carries the bacillus, the virus of what we're still suffering through, not just in the Middle East, but also in the West, which is the revolutionary Islamic government's mindset, its millenarianism, its totalitarianism, its subjugation of the people of Iran, and therefore the desire for the subjugation of people across the wider region, the revolutionary nature of the regime in Tehran since 1979. And this regime is what has spread its spores across the region, and I think as far as Columbia University and academia in the West. If the plane had not taken off, we would be living in a different world. And yes, so that's one of the reasons I start from 1979. I think people can't understand what is happening in the Middle East or indeed the wider world now without understanding the nature of Khomeiniism and what Khomeini and his successors have attempted to bring about.
So what is that nature? What is that mindset that you allude to?
Well,
that is being brought in, not on a train, but on a flight.
One, of course, as I say, is a theological aspect of Shia Islam, which is a very, very radical, perhaps the most radical version of it. There are strains of Shia Islam, as in Sunni Islam, that do not need to lead to this, but this is the one that Khomeini brought with him. He had very specific views of how to govern not just Iran, but all societies, particularly starting with all Islamic societies. He made his views extremely clear. He was an end-time cultist, among other things. And he had a specific animus, of course, against the Jews and the Jewish state. As you know, but many people do not. I mean, Iran and Israel used to have ambassadors. And I think there's a gentleman who's still alive I met many years ago who was the Israeli ambassador to Tehran in the 1970s. There was a normalization, which was, of course, completely reversed after 79. Because the Ayatollahs have a particular death wish against the Jewish state. Some years ago, I don't mention this in the book, but I think I've mentioned it publicly before. Some years ago, a couple of friends of mine went for breakfast with the Ayatollah Khomeini. I don't have very many friends who've breakfasted with him, so I'm sort of was all ears when they told me about it. And there was Spanish friends, and they were on a delegation. They were phoned up, would you like to have breakfast with the Ayatollah in the morning? Yes. Who wouldn't? I'd love to. But my invitation got lost in the post. But anyway, the point is they went, they said there were many interesting things. One was that there was a sort of choir of clerics behind the Ayatollah as he sat at the breakfast table. It's always slightly unnerving, or at least interesting. But the thing that they said, which really stuck with me, this is 15, 20 years ago now, was that to break the ice, they said through the translator, you know, what do you do first thing in the morning? Expecting the Ayatollah to say, you know, well, they'd say, you know, I have a cappuccino and, you know, or tea. You know, that was what they were actually asking. The question goes through the translator, the Ayatollah replies, it comes through, the first thing I do in the morning is to work out how I can destroy the Zionist entity.
That's what he said to foreign journalists.
And so that...
my immediate reaction as an Israeli, as a Jew, is to chuckle.
Mm.
But it's a little bit out of nervousness.
Yeah, sure. You bet.
Not that I believe it, that the Ayatollah wakes up, and I think he wakes up and, like most people, brushes his teeth, hopefully, has some coffee. But the fact that that is an answer that he thinks should be given, especially to foreign journalists, it would make him look stronger rather than weaker.
Right. I mean, it's a very interesting question always with totalitarian leaders like Khomeini is, you know, the extent to which you believe them, take them seriously or otherwise, and the proximate threat of their crazed beliefs. But I do believe that in the period since October 7th, on October the 7th, the people of Israel got a very sharp taste of what Khomeini, the backers of Hamas and others, what they really want. And having spent most of the period since October 7th covering the wars in Gaza and Lebanon and Israel, one of the things we now know is that what happened on the 7th in the south of Israel was intended to also happen in the north. And the plan was, which Iran knew about, was that Hezbollah would come from the north, Hamas from the south, and they would effectively garrote Israel from the center. There's a very interesting question about why Hezbollah didn't go off at the same time, although they started launching rockets within 24 hours from the north, into the north from Lebanon. But it seems that Hamas did not want to communicate the date, although everyone knew this was the plan. Hezbollah, Hamas, Tehran, they knew this was a plan. Hamas could not find a way to communicate the exact date to Hezbollah without the fear that it would be intercepted. They had no means of communication that they trusted. And they, of course, thought that if they were intercepted, then the Israelis and Israel's allies could have stopped Hamas from the raping and torturing and killing and burning that they were so keen to do in the south of Israel on the 7th.
But to play devil's advocate or Khomeini's advocate, you said that Iran knew perfectly well. Knowledge of an action does not mean that you orchestrated the action.
No, but knowledge of the action plus arming of the actors, plus funding of the actors, and plus assistance of every possible kind to the actors does make you vaguely complicit.
Right. And this is true both for Hamas in the south and Hezbollah in the north.
Very much so.
And the Houthis, we must say.
And the Houthis. Yemen. I mean, you know, the Houthis have recently been discovered by adults in the West who never meet a terrorist anti-Western group who they don't adore. the Houthis. I mean, who thought that the Houthis, who can't do anything, I mean, they can't do anything, are totally hopeless and have an impoverished country thanks to their own actions and to the actions of some of their neighbors. Who thought they could fire extremely developed weapons straight at Tel Aviv and indeed almost hit the American consulate in Tel Aviv with an unmanned drone? Who knew that the Houthis, who can't keep the lights on, would be so filled with the most advanced weaponry? Well, only because of Tehran. Amazingly enough, the Houthis aren't great builders of things.
So let's delve into the book. Again, I'll say it's On Democracies and Death Cults, Israel and the Future of Civilization. And I feel like this book is written from the eyes of and the pen of a journalist.
Hmm.
You know, I've read your previous books, and they're more of an author sitting down, taking the time. And this felt almost like this has to come out.
Mm.
I have to tell this. Can you take us back to the first time you landed in Israel after October 7th?
Mm.
You've been in Israel multiple times. What was different?
Well, everything was different. The first war I saw in Israel was in the 2006 Lebanon War, the second Lebanon War, the Hezbollah War. And I knew the outlines of the Gaza wars and had seen that as well in the years since the disengagement of 2005. For me, as for most Israelis and others, there were certain things that by the time I woke up in New York on the 7th and started getting messages from friends and colleagues and others, there were certain things that immediately hit me, that this was totally different from anything else. And for me, like a lot of other people, it was actually the sight of a Hamas truck going down a street I know in Sderot in the south of Israel and firing an RPG down the center of the street. I was like, I have been in Sderot many times. I'd been in the bomb shelters of Sderot as Hamas were firing Katusha rockets. I knew what the citizenry of that town had gone through since the disengagement from Gaza, but never did I expect to see Hamas terrorists firing an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade, down the main street and fighting house to house and taking over the police station and having huge battles and so on. So that, for me, was the first realization that something was totally different. When I got to Israel, going round the kibbutzim in the south, the communities in the south, and seeing and hearing firsthand what had happened, made me realize very fast that this was on order of magnitude different from anything that had happened before.
Do you remember where you went first from airport?
Yes, I went to a kibbutz near Oz, which is a small community of several hundred people who, as you know, about a third or a quarter of the community were either murdered in their homes or kidnapped and taken into Gaza that day. Terrible, terrible sights. And having written about the ideology of the Islamic extremist groups like Hamas for many years, and not being any stranger to the ideology or to the barbarism or the violence these movements have, nevertheless, there was one aspect to it in particular which it shocked me. It shocked me, despite, as I say, sort of not being surprised. But that was the joy of the attackers, the joy of the terrorists, the unbelievable delight they took in acts of unimaginable savagery. And this was something which I thought about a lot as I listened to survivors and families and others. I could not get out of my head the wild ecstasy of the people doing the killing that morning, and that many, many survivors relayed to me, you know, versions of this, and I heard recordings of it and videos taken by Hamas themselves, of course, that showed this. But the ecstasy was of an order which I knew about in other death cults historically. I mean, there's a story from one of the great Spanish philosophers of the last century who wrote a book called The Tragic Sense of Life. He, when he was trying to resist Francoism in the 30s in Spain, once described a group of young far-right radicals who end up at a meeting chanting Viva la Muerte, long live death. He talks about this as a necrophilic chant. The death cult of Hamas is likewise one that rejoices in necrophilic chants in favor of death, glorifying death. And one of the things that I write about in the book, as you know, but which is especially jarring, is that this necrophilic death cult should have walked into, run into, driven into communities of people for whom this was like night meeting day. Two worlds that should never meet. The world of young people at a dance party, just wanting to celebrate life, meeting people who celebrate death, people who want to expand their consciousness and be at one with the universe and love everyone, meeting people so high on death. This was one of the things I kept coming back to as I interviewed people, and as I researched and as I traveled, and as I... This was one of the things that really made me want to write this book, was that thing what I describe as the meeting of a democracy and a death cult. But there are very many other versions of that I could lay out.
I want to give people a little bit of a sense of the things you've saw and the things that you talk about in the book. And obviously it's just impossible to cover all of it. You'll have to buy the book and read it. But you mentioned something, and I want to emphasize the things that people may have not know so much about. You mention, you write about the Thai workers' residence in near Oz. Can you explain to people what are the Thai workers doing there? What did you see there? What happened?
Yes, that was a particularly gruesome day. They some of the kibbutz in the south have workers who are employed and live in the community, and are from other countries. There are some Thai workers in kibbutz near Oz, and they, in their accommodation, I mean, these communities are also, they're not, it should be said, they're not wealthy, they're not filled with wealthy people. They're good people who want to farm the land and so on. And the Thai workers in near Oz, also on the morning of the 7th, the Hamas came door to door through their living quarters, as they did through everyone else's. And yes, they seemed to have, the pathologist was still there when I was there. The Hamas seemed to have robbed what little they could take from the Thai workers, about 17 of them, if I remember rightly, who were there. They seemed to have rounded them all up, put them into a bomb shelter, and then they just massacred them all.
What did you see?
I mean, it was...
And I ask not to be sensational, just because most people don't get to see what you saw.
Oh, I mean, it was just a massacre. I mean, it was a tiny room in which these poor souls spent their last minutes cooped up. About 12 of them, I think, were in that room, and Hamas just used... machine guns and machetes to just finish all of them off in one go. And it wasn't just that there was blood everywhere on the floor, but I mean, the ceilings, blood splatter across the air conditioning units, and just matter everywhere.
Why these Thai workers? They're not Jewish.
It's very interesting that Hamas went in to kill as many Israelis, as many Jews as they could, and that's what their death chants are. They're all about the Yehud, the Jews. But they killed other people who were there as well in this ecstasy of death that they were engaged in. Maybe they thought they weren't worth taking as hostages. I mean, they did take Thai hostages, but they're not as valuable to Hamas as Jewish hostages, you know. In the amazing math of Hamas, you know, it's a Jew that's like the most useful to kill or to capture. But they killed Arab Israelis as well. There was a doctor who I interviewed, very, very brave and impressive man, works at a hospital in the south, and I interviewed him. He's a member of Hatzalah, this first responder unit, which is amazing thing. And he got alerts like a lot of Hatzalah people do. It's usually to a car crash or an accident somewhere, and you go and you put on your medical kit and you help. It's a volunteer organization. he was driving to work. He is left his wife at 6 a.m. to go and do his shift at the hospital, gets the alerts at 6:30 when the rockets are starting to land, and then gets an alert that there's a seems to be some crash or something on the highway, goes to it, is surprised that when he's going to the car, he's shot at by men in IDF uniforms. Well, the men turned out to be Hamas, and they'd killed IDF Israeli soldiers where they'd first found them, put on their uniforms. And that was one of the reasons why there was a lot of confusion on the morning, was that all sorts of things like that were happening. They shoot at him, and he has his protective vest on, so he's shot in the chest, and he survives that. He tells them he's Muslim, and they use him as a human shield because they believe that it means that the Israelis, if they're in the air, will not kill them because they've got an Israeli, albeit an Arab Israeli Muslim, but that's extra use to them, as it were. And in the end, they use him as a human shield for some time, and then they shoot him. He survived.
A lot of people have used that term, human shield. I'm not sure. It's one of those terms that people use without knowing what it plays out in the real world. What does it mean when people say Hamas uses civilians as human shields?
It's quite straightforward. If you had a gun on you now, or a knife, and I was sitting here and I didn't have a gun or a knife, and I had a child here who belonged to somebody, and I grab the child and I hold them in front of me, I'm trying to save my life by daring you to kill the child in order to kill me or get to me. Now, this is widely regarded in civilized society as not being a good thing to do.
And also a crime of war.
Yes, but that's how Hamas operate. And, it's one of the interesting things I'm trying to explore in the book is what happens when these two totally different worlds of war operating meet. What happens, nobody needs to take my word from it. I quote leadership of Hamas on this. When the leaders of Hamas are asked why civilians in Gaza are not allowed to shelter in the vast tunnel network which your tax dollars and my tax dollars helped to build, when the leadership of Hamas are asked, why are the citizens of Gaza not allowed to be in these tunnels that you've built? The answer is, it's because the tunnels are for our fighters, Hamas fighters, and for our rockets. Like, we can't have Gazan civilians using this precious rocket storage shelter merely to save their lives. What is it like when that world of war meets the world of war of Israel, which unfortunately has had to build shelter after shelter across the country to protect its citizenry from rocket fire? This is the difference between two different ways of war. But Israel, like any Western army, is forced to, and rightly so, operate within the norms of war. People can debate and argue about certain actions or certain operations or parts of operating procedure. But, I mean, the IDF does not grab, Gazan civilians to the IDF in order that Hamas kills the Gazan civilian. And apart from the fact you're not allowed to do that in the laws of war, in any case, Hamas wouldn't care, because for them it's a win-win. I mean, the Gazan civilians, for them, are delightful damage. I mean, again, it's very, very hard for most Westerners to comprehend the means of war that Hamas operate under. One time, I was in Gaza a lot with the IDF, and one time I was speaking to a soldier about the complexity of a part of the operation in one of the cities in Gaza. And he said, one of the problems is that every single day we have groups of civilians coming out with their hands in the air in areas we need to operate in, and we're trying to clear civilians in order to get to Hamas. And every day, multiple times a day, groups of civilians will come out of a building with their hands in the air or waving a white flag, And in the from the middle of the group of civilians, also dressed as civilians, will come Hamas fighters firing at us, at the IDF. That is a crime of war. You're not allowed, you're not meant to dress in civilian clothing and live among civilians and fight, because you put the civilian population at risk. Amazingly enough, Hamas does not care about the civilian population of Gaza.
And you discuss the Hamas infrastructure in the book. Mm. And you have an interesting story of someone you identify as Major Y.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes into a house, a regular civilian house. He says, we skip the bedrooms, the parents' bedrooms. We skip the living room. We skip the kitchen. We go straight into the yes. children's room. And when people just read that, yeah. that is an admission of, look, the IDF is doing the worst of the worst. The soldiers are coming in and they yes. go straight to the children's room.
Can you imagine it? Yeah, absolutely. How barbarian of them. This is the lack of understanding.
But to explain, why are they going into the children's room?
Every soldier I spoke to who was involved in house-to-house operations to find tunnel entrances and weaponry said the same thing. They all said the same thing as Major Y. Everybody very, very, very fast from the beginning of the operation in Gaza, the IDF worked out that, yes, if you go into a house, if you're looking for the entrances to the tunnel networks to try to find the hostages or the Hamas leadership, or if you're going to try to find the weaponry, apart from the fact that weapons were in every second to third house found. So, I mean, the whole of the Gaza was weaponized. And that's just a very important thing to keep in mind. But they worked out very fast. If you're looking for weapons, if you're looking for the tunnel entrances, just go straight to the children's bedrooms, because that's where Hamas have put them.
Why?
Because they know, again, that it's a win-win for them. It's a win-win. Either the rocket-propelled grenade, as I give one example, is sitting under the child's cot and is not found, because the Israeli army will not go and turn over the child's cot. Or it's found and you can say how appalling that the Israelis are turning over children's cots. It again and again, it is just, having seen so much of this up close, it is so incredibly frustrating, the lack of understanding of the rules of war that Hamas simply used to their advantage. You know, you'll turn on the evening news and you'll see the BBC or somewhere else say that the Israelis attacked a mosque or fired at a mosque in Gaza. And they will not tell you that, you know, I mean, it happened actually with Gadi Eisenkot's nephew was killed in one of the operations in Gaza where
Gadi Eisenkot was a former chief of staff in Israel in the IDF and is a member of
the war cabinet at the time, lost his son and his nephew in Gaza. I think it was Eisenkot's nephew who was killed when, you know, Hamas started the fighters, the terrorists flooded out from tunnels underneath a mosque, firing from the top of the mosque, killing Israeli soldiers, and brilliant for Hamas and amazing that people don't understand that this is how they operate. They do that because, again, it's a win-win. Either the IDF cannot fire back because it's a mosque and therefore a protected space, like hospitals, like schools are meant to be, or they fire back and then everyone can say, look at the vicious Israelis firing at a mosque. Same with the hospitals. When I was just up the road from the Shifa compound, I won't call it Shifa Hospital because it's not primarily a hospital. It's a Hamas operating compound. And by the way, even in the 2014 war, the BBC was identifying the Shifa Hospital as being a Hamas command headquarter. The Shifa complex was used by Hamas in the knowledge that, again, it's a win-win. They took hostages there on the 7th of October to hide them, to get them into the tunnel networks. If the Israelis go after them and they go there, then the world's media will say Israelis attack Shifa Hospital. And if they don't, then the Israeli prisoners can be smuggled through with ease. The way in which the international media has totally failed to educate its readers and its viewers that this is how Hamas wages war is still staggering to me. I give an example in the book, I think, but of Jeremy Bowen, who's a lifelong disliker of Israel, who's also the chief BBC correspondent in the Middle East, who, by the way, you might have seen the other week, did a fawning interview with the new leader of Syria. It was like if he'd been interviewing a politician in Britain, he'd have been, now, why do you say this? Blah, blah, blah. Why, and you once said this, and you once did that. Oh, but with a jihadist leader of Syria, it's all, oh, Eminence, your grace. Wonderful. Thank you so much for sparing the time. Anyway, the point is that this man, Jeremy Bowen, he was asked on air when the Israelis showed the tunnel compounds under the Shifa hospital and the arms found, because they found not only Kalashnikovs, but RPGs and grenades and much more. He's asked on air, doesn't this demonstrate the Israelis' claim that the Shifa hospital is not actually primarily a hospital, but is a Hamas command headquarters? And Jeremy Bowen of the BBC says, well, it's you know, what you've got to understand is that in that part of the world, guns are a bit more commonplace than they are in the UK. And, you know, lots of people have Kalashnikovs. And he said it's not impossible that the Kalashnikovs belonged to the hospital's security department.
What about the rocket-propelled grenades?
As I said, I think that the grenades then, it's not inconceivable, they belonged to the cardiology department. This is preposterous, and it is being done during this war, as in every other war involving Israel, at the highest levels of the media and governments like the ignoramus government in Dublin, all of whom think they understand how to run a house-to-house war against the death cult. And none of them have a darn idea. And what's stunning to me
is it ignorance or is it something else?
Well, that's a very, very important thing to add, which is when I say they don't have a darn idea, one of the things that is staggering to me is they don't seem to want to have an idea. In fact, they positively shelter themselves from having an idea. And that's where your question becomes the most pertinent one. Why do they not want to have an idea? There are various explanations for that.
Unlike many other episodes, we took our time. So today we will be releasing the first part of a two-part episode, but I urge you to listen to all of it and to the next part that will be released next week. Here I am with Douglas Murray.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."